it's pretty scary being in the dark. It's going to be muddy water. They won't be able to see anything. So that'll really be the hardest thing for the kids.
A dramatic rescue, but more Thai boys remain trapped in a cave. It's Monday, July 9th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, not everyone fears tech ties with China. Speaking not so freely in Pakistan. Climate help from space. Better bone grafts. And a virtual view of our world. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Rescuers in Thailand extracted four boys Sunday as efforts are to continue to save the remaining members of a soccer team and their coach who have been trapped in a cave since June 23rd. One rescuer died Friday, and as Arash Arabasadi tells us, rescue teams are moving fast with a week of rain forecast ahead.
Thai Navy SEALs confirm more than a dozen divers safely returned from the operations. The rescue effort paused for the night, but with rain in the forecast and oxygen levels in the cave dropping, the stakes are high for those still trapped below. The acting governor and mission commander said at a news conference that rescue efforts are on hold, but added that the operation is going better than expected. Retired U.S. Marine Duke Speed spent half of his 20-year career working in amphibious reconnaissance. He is an expert in confined space, high-risk diving operations. He says the rescue pause is a matter of logistics.
They're going to need to, recharge those tanks that were positioned along the route. So that would mean actually getting those tanks out of the cave, recharging them, with compressed air. And the other thing might be that, just letting those divers that just completed the operation, get some rest.
Thai Navy SEALs lost one of their own Friday during an early rescue effort. Saman Gunan dropped spare air tanks along the escape route of the cave, but he ran out of air and drowned on his swim to the surface. This video, released by Thai Navy SEALs, shows the 12 boys and their coach trapped in the cave since June 23rd. The boys and their 25-year-old coach wandered too far into the underground labyrinth before fast-rising water cut off their only exit. SEAL divers found the team alive on July 2nd. Since then, special operations teams, rescue workers, and volunteers have been trying to get them out. Sunday marked the first successful rescue operation. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Rescuers have been pumping water out at about 1 centimeter per hour, but still, some areas are filled with water to the ceiling. That makes diving the only real immediate option. 13 sets of diving equipment have been made available, and each person has been given basic diving instructions. Alan Worrild is captain of the New South Wales Cave Rescue Squad in Australia. He tells VOA's Victor Beattie, diving out of the cave carries some risk.
Normally it takes years for people to be competent cave divers. But saying that, these kids aren't going to have to sort of dive much for themselves. All they really have to do is, be underwater and keep breathing, and the divers will carry them through.
So you're saying it may not be a difficult process?
No, I think it's going to be quite difficult for them to just keep their cool and not panic underwater. I mean, it's pretty scary being in the dark. It's going to be muddy water. They won't be able to see anything. So that will really be the hardest thing for the kids, is just kind of staying calm as they're taken out, really. They'll be in and out of the water a lot. You don't move very fast, and they'll sort of go through a short flooded section, then they'll be in the air and have to probably the amount of water wade through the water and then get ready to go in the water again and then go through another short flooded section, probably climb over boulders and things along the way with a lot of heavy gear. That's why it takes so long.
How risky is this?
It is a lot of risk, again, with the kids panicking more than anything else. I mean, there's also the risk, of course, just losing the line or something. But the bigger risk, of course, is when it starts raining heavily again, the whole scene's going to change. There's going to be a lot more water and a lot more current, the current washing people around and washing people, I'm not sure, in. And depends where they are, which way it gets, washed them a bit out and a bit in. So fighting strong currents, just you use up a lot of air and a lot of energy. Yeah, they have to do things fairly quick, I think.
The heavy amount of rain during the monsoon season will also play a big role.
The prediction I saw was it's going to rain heavy on Sunday. The problem, I think, is that a lot of the cave will flood very badly, flood up to the roof, so there'll be no safe place in it for a lot of areas. Probably the halfway alternative is they can find a safe place to move to and not actually come all the way out, which takes a lot more time. They may be able to move just to a safer spot.
The other concern for rescuers is the physical and mental health of those trapped after their prolonged ordeal, but they've been given some encouraging advice from a formerly trapped miner, Mario Sepúlveda, who was trapped underground for 69 days in a Chilean mine in 2010, encouraged the boys in a video message to remain positive. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find currently trending on VOAnews.com. First, four boys rescued from Thai cave. Japan downpour kills at least 66, strands 1,000. 41 dead, 15 still missing in boat accident off Thai island. Secretary of State says North Korea could have ties with the United States like Vietnam. U.S. warships pass through Taiwan Strait. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. U.S. policymakers are raising national security concerns about Chinese money flooding into U.S. startups in fields such as artificial intelligence and robotics. Michelle Quinn reports from Silicon Valley, where there's a sense that ties with China are mutually beneficial.
In the U.S. Capitol, there's a clear sense that China threatens American security.
I assure you that the threat China poses is real and that dangers we worry about are already taking effect. Our inaction can only have negative consequences, and we need to aim to prevent any future negative consequences to our country.
Lawmakers worry about Chinese advances in defense-related technologies, such as artificial intelligence and robotics. But in Silicon Valley, there's a greater worry that a crackdown on Chinese investments will hinder growth and innovation.
They don't want to see it happen through tariffs that have the impact potentially of just vastly shutting down trade, or policies that take some kind of a sledgehammer approach to investment, which by and large from China here has been beneficial.
Here at what is billed as the first U.S.-China summit on AI technologies, the focus is on finding common ground. People here say both countries are pushing forward on AI applications in areas such as healthcare, automobiles and drones, and can learn from each other.
Technology is shared and collaborative, and also for the better of the humankind. So I don't think it's one country against another country.
So regardless of geopolitical pressure or differences, from technology perspective, we are looking to solve the society's problems. Being healthcare, being fintech, being transportation.
Helen Liang is the managing partner at a firm that specializes in helping companies develop Chinese business relationships. One of her investments, Piper, a do-it-yourself computer kit, is trying to break into China's educational market.
So you're building the game as you play.
U.S. companies like Piper have always looked at China for its vast number of potential customers. But more AI firms now are looking for help with innovation.
We have been used to disruptive business models emerging from the Silicon Valley here. This is changing. We are now, in fintech, for example, in healthcare, seeing new and disruptive business models emerging from China.
Disruption is a favorite term in Silicon Valley, describing how new technologies can lead to dramatic and unpredictable results on an industry. That potential is what excites these entrepreneurs and worries some lawmakers back in Washington. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Happening now in Asia, unprecedented rains that have killed at least 66 people also stranded 1,000 in the western Japanese city of Kurashiki on Sunday, including about 100 at a hospital, with rescuers using helicopters and boats after rivers surged over their banks. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We'll be right back.
You're starting out your week with VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us. Pakistan has a mixed record on press freedoms. Although the media is vibrant and there are many TV news channels, state and non-state actors often threaten or harass journalists. Since last year, harassment from state actors, especially against those critical of Pakistan's powerful military or intelligence agencies, has significantly intensified. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Islamabad.
When journalist Marvi Sirmad returned home with her family last week from vacation, she was shocked to find her house upside down. She feared a robbery until she noticed that most of her valuables, like watches and jewelry, were taken out of drawers but left behind, whereas two laptops, a phone, and some of her family's travel documents were missing. The pattern was disturbingly familiar. This was the third time this had happened to her.
They've gone through my files on human rights cases. They only took laptops with current data on them. Similarly, they checked my voice recorders thoroughly. What kind of thieves are interested in only data and documents?
Sirmad is a known critic of the military as well as extremist groups. According to the Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, anyone critical of the state these days is being targeted, reportedly by security agencies. While journalists in Pakistan are used to harassment from state and non-state actors, the intensity and frequency has increased significantly since last year. In a recent report on Pakistan, Amnesty International highlighted the impunity with which journalists and rights activists are subjected to harassment, threats, attacks, and even enforced disappearances. Increasingly, newspaper columnists are openly complaining that editorial comments have been subjected to censorship. Pakistan's oldest English-language newspaper, Dawn, published a statement complaining that officials have threatened newspaper hawkers and disrupted paper distribution in parts of the country. On the other hand, Pakistan military spokesman has accused some journalists of becoming pawns to anti-state elements.
What do we do about these that we have left blank? They are using their original handles to retweet or approve of tweets that are against the country.
The pressure has intensified to the extent that a recent survey by advocacy group Media Matters for Democracy found that 88% of Pakistani journalists self-censor. Free speech advocates are demanding an end to the harassment. So far, they say they have not received a positive response. Meanwhile, Sirmad and her family wonder how many more times they'll have to pick up the pieces. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
Coming up, help on the ground from pictures above. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, the death toll from the tourist boat accident off the southern Thai resort island of Phuket has risen to 41. Officials say divers and others are searching for 15 people who are still missing. The boat was carrying 93 tourists, 11 crew, and one tour guide when it was slammed Thursday by a 5-meter-high wave. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, an Australian-made camera that can help fight brush fires and monitor the health of the Great Barrier Reef is on its way to the International Space Station. Scientists say the technology will help save lives in natural disasters. From Sydney, Phil Mercer provides a snapshot.
The so-called Earth Sensing Imaging Spectrometer was built at La Trobe University in Melbourne and was developed over 3 years by Australian scientists and German engineers. It's one of the world's most advanced cameras, and its images are far superior to current satellite technology. In orbit, the device will take sequences of high-resolution pictures of the Earth's surface that its designers say will help emergency crews fight wildfires through infrared maps. It will also assist in the response to floods, storms and droughts. The camera's sharp images will be able to measure the runoff of pollutants from land and detect the illegal dumping of chemicals on the Great Barrier Reef that stretches down Australia's northeast coast. The camera was launched Friday from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on board entrepreneur Elon Musk's SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and will take 3 days to reach the International Space Station. Peter Moore, a senior lecturer at La Trobe University, says the launch had to go to plan.
When it comes to space, you've got one shot at it, and that's it. You've got to get it right. This is an advanced instrument for space. This is going to provide imagery to save lives during natural disasters such as fires and floods. It's very difficult to create reliable electronics, hardware and software for space.
Scientists say the device has been built to withstand the punishing extremes in space, where temperatures can fall to minus 270 degrees Celsius. It's scheduled to remain in orbit for 4 years, when it will be brought home and examined to see how it coped in that environment. Authorities in Australia say the project is further proof of a burgeoning domestic space industry. Australia's new space agency began officially on July 1, although a site for the organisation has yet to be found. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia, two U.S. warships pass through the Taiwan Strait on a voyage that will likely be viewed in the self-ruled island as a sign of support by President Donald Trump amid heightened tension with China. Washington has no formal ties with Taiwan, but is bound by law to help it defend itself. You'll find the big stories every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, orthopedic surgery can be tricky. So researchers at Northwestern University are engineering new materials to make 3D printed bones that are a perfect match, ready for grafts. VOA's Faith Lapidus stitches the details together.
Hey Lucy, how are you?
Orthopedic surgeon Nirav Shah specializes in shoulders and knees. He replaced Lucy Boyajian's shoulder 3 months ago. One titanium joint later, she's doing well. But what if he could have ordered up a 3D printed shoulder, customized to her measurements?
What Rommel and Adam have done is they've created something very, very unique, very, very innovative, and a game changer in many aspects. In essence, they've created a synthetic bone, if you would.
Rommel Shah is Dr. Shah's wife and a material scientist at Northwestern University. With support from the National Science Foundation, she and engineer Adam Jakis have developed a new 3D-printed synthetic material called hyperelastic bone.
What 3D printing allows us to do also is to make patient-specific or patient-matched implants, where if a patient comes in with a defect, say a craniofacial defect, we're able to take a scan of that defect and print it into the right size and shape that fits that patient perfectly.
Unlike a bone graft from a patient's own body or from metal or traditional ceramic, the new synthetic bone is made of an elastic ceramic, so if it's squished, it bounces back to its original shape. It starts as a liquid ink and is printed out in whatever shape the doctors need. The process is fast, and everything happens at room temperature.
It deposits on a surface, and wherever we put the material, it goes where we want it to go.
They also print sheets.
So with the flat sheets, we're able to create off-the-shelf products where the surgeon can take these sheets and cut it down to size. It can be rolled as well. It can be sutured. It can be folded.
Once implanted, the hyperelastic bone promotes tissue growth, and it becomes part of the patient's own bone as it regenerates.
So once implanted inside the body, the hyperelastic bone eventually becomes new bone. It becomes part of you.
The new synthetic bone is less expensive than what's been available up until now, and it handles better in the operating room. Dr. Shah says surgeons are ready to embrace this advance and its implications for improving patient outcomes. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
famine, feast, fire, and ice. It's a four-part documentary on climate change. The series premiered at AFI Docs, the American Film Institute's documentary festival in Washington, D.C. It was made using virtual reality technology that gives viewers a 360-degree view of the destructive consequences of climate change on our planet. VOA's Penelope Palou spoke with filmmaker Eric Strauss about the impact of virtual reality technology on filmmaking and on viewers.
Melting glaciers and rising seas in Greenland, raging fires in Northern California, the relentless drought in Somalia, and the disappearing Amazon forests. The virtual reality series called Ice, Fire, Famine, and Feast by filmmakers Eric Strauss and Danfeng Dennis immerses viewers into the extremes of Earth's changing climate.
Hopefully, when someone watches the whole series, drives home this idea that there's no hiding from this. This is coming for all of us, regardless of where we live or what our income is. It's going to affect everyone, and that hopefully drives home the urgency that this is something that all nations need to really pay attention to and start combating.
At the festival's headquarters in Washington, D.C., viewers get a 360-degree view of the effects of climate change through VR goggles.
Some people have a very visceral physical reaction where they jump or they kind of yelp because they're very surprised by what they see. And other people, I think, are very reflective and, you know, can even be sad depending on the content.
Viewer James Willard describes the experience of watching the installment Feast about the deforestation of the Amazon rainforests to make space for industrial-sized cattle ranches to satisfy the global appetite for beef.
You're completely immersed in this whole situation, in this whole story. You're facing these animals eye to eye and watching them as they're marching basically towards their death.
The film needs no dialogue.
Virtual reality is about experience. It's actually kind of stripping away a lot of the information, putting you in environments that you then experience for yourself. You're much more of a protagonist in some way in these types of stories than you would be in a traditional form of cinema.
Another viewer, Patricia, has just watched Famine, the episode that looks at the effects of extreme drought in Somalia.
It just makes it even more powerful because you feel like you're there. And I think it's a great medium to spread the word on critical subjects.
That is the goal, to affect change, to affect positive change.
VR films are becoming more accessible as the technology evolves and are often viewed on smartphone applications. But VR programmer Ken Jacobson says watching them through a virtual reality headset is still the best way to experience them.
I think there'll continue to be developments in the technology of the headset, so pretty soon people will not be so conscious of the headset, and also the optics will improve.
But can virtual reality ever replace the traditional 2D or even 3D films?
I think that it's going to add another aspect to how we're going to experience movies and such, but I don't think that it's going to take over. Virtual reality, I feel like, can be very dangerous at times because you're completely immersing yourself within this story. Some people will be able to take it and then take off the goggles and then live life as normal, but some people might not be able to do so. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to completely take over.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on great radio stations around Asia, like DZUP, 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines Diliman in Quezon City. We thank everyone there who had tuned in today. You can also find our full-length programs online at VOA Asia Facebook and at our website, voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.